Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. People struggling with addiction and severe mental illness could be referred and court-ordered into treatment under a proposal by Governor Gavin Newsom. The plan, called Care Court, is meant to address California's worsening homelessness crisis. While supporters say Care Court could help fix a broken mental health system, not everyone is on board. Some civil rights groups and advocates for people experiencing homelessness oppose it. CAP Radio reporter Chris Nichols covers homelessness and is here to discuss the governor's plan. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Vicky. It's good to be here.
This proposal was unveiled earlier this month. Can you remind us about Newsom's Care Court plan and how essentially it would work?
Sure. This would be a referral-based program. It would allow first responders like police and paramedics to refer people who are struggling with addiction and mental illness, including those who are homeless and struggling with those conditions, to the Care Court program. Families would also be able to make these referrals. And based on what the governor has said so far, a clinical team would evaluate the person and determine whether they should be part of Care Court. And if that answer is yes, then the individual would be entitled to due process, including a public defender, and they would appear before a civil court judge. And the judge ultimately could order people into treatment programs for between 1 to 2 years. And finally, if the individual is not able to complete that program, then the court could appoint a conservator to care for that person and to manage their affairs.
In addition to the governor, who else are the plan supporters?
The plan has the backing of several big city mayors across the state, both Democrats and Republicans. And those include mayors from Los Angeles, San Diego, Fresno, Bakersfield, San Jose, and Oakland. But it also has local support from Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg, who's long advocated for improving the state's mental health system.
Well, as we're about to learn in just a moment, the plan has drawn criticism from civil rights groups. But when it comes to these mayors who support this proposal and this plan, why do they think Care Court is the right move?
Well, they've acknowledged that it's a controversial plan and one that could force a person to go forward with treatment. But they also point to the status quo. They say that our current mental health care system is broken. And in a recent press conference, they said that they want to end what they described as a cycle or a pattern that often sends homeless people with mental illnesses to psychiatric centers for just a few days, but then sends them back out to the streets without any lasting care. They also pointed out that many end up in local jails, which are not equipped to provide mental health and addiction treatment. Mayor Steinberg argued that the law needs to change, and both the individual and government should be compelled to act.
Why, when it comes to housing, why, when it comes to shelter, why, when it comes to providing treatment for people who are living in squalor on our streets, is it a voluntary and optional act of government? I don't get it.
Now, in the city of Sacramento, Steinberg has proposed what he calls a right to housing ordinance. It also includes an obligation for government and for people who are homeless. His plan, if eventually approved by the city council, would compel the city to approve thousands of shelter spaces and housing units for people who are homeless. And once those are built, or if they are built, the ordinance would obligate people who are offered shelter or housing to accept it.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio's Chris Nichols about the governor's proposal for care courts to compel those with severe mental illness and substance abuse to receive court-ordered treatment. We know that civil rights advocates have questions about Steinberg's plan, and they also have concerns about the governor's care court. Which groups oppose it and why?
Groups including the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California and Disability Rights California have some big concerns. So do some advocates for people experiencing homelessness. Lily Graham is an attorney with Disability Rights California.
We are very much worried about the fundamental concept of mental health care as part of a court-ordered treatment. We see it as coerced treatment. We see it as forced treatment. And that is the antithesis of what underlies disability rights, the right to self-determined care.
Graham says her group is also concerned about the broad language in the proposal and about who would be subject to these courts. She said at first the language was unhoused people who have schizophrenia. Now it's people with mental illness and substance use disorders. And she feels that opens this up to a much larger population just than just people who are homeless.
Yeah, that's a more general classification. Chrissy also spoke with a nonprofit group that advocates for more affordable housing and greater homeless services. What did they have to say about the care court idea?
Well, I spoke with Mari Castaldi of Housing California, and she, like other advocates, said that California and its local governments need to do a better job of making existing mental health and drug treatment programs both available and accessible to people who are homeless. She says if anyone should be compelled to act, it should be the government and not individuals.
We're interested in the idea of compelling our systems of behavioral health care and of affordable housing to truly reform so that those resources can be available at the scale that they can really be seen as sort of a right and can be accessible to anyone who needs them. But we're concerned about sort of compelling individuals through a legal process with implied threats of referral to conservatorship or incarceration, knowing that we do not at this time have the resources at the scale needed to provide those services on a voluntary basis.
And to clarify one of the points that Castaldi made, she said that based on her knowledge of the plan, someone who is going through a criminal court proceeding could potentially be referred over as a candidate for care court. But if they were not compliant with the program, they could be referred back to the criminal proceeding. Now, the Newsom administration is hearing from groups like Housing California and Disability Rights California through a stakeholder engagement process. And Castaldi says she's hopeful that some changes will be made.
Yeah, and with those meetings, there could with those meetings, there can be some revisions. Chris, if existing services are lacking, and we know that there's a housing affordability issue, not to mention units are a statewide issue, does the Care Court proposal identify how it will address this?
Well, the governor has said that people would be housed when they go through this process, but advocates are worried. They say as it stands right now, the Care Court proposal is just not clear about how people would be housed during this mandatory treatment. And of course, as just about everyone in California knows, there's already a severe shortage of affordable housing.
What are the next steps for the governor's proposal? When could this potentially become a reality?
Well, Care Court would have to be approved by the legislature, and Newsom is asking lawmakers to include it in the state budget, which if that happens, would allow it to take effect as early as July.
And we just got a release, I believe yesterday, from the governor's office. There's actually going to be a discussion about Care Court today. What do you know about it?
That's right. The governor is traveling around the state to hold what he's calling essentially Care Court roundtables. So he's going to be in Napa County today, and this discussion will include what the administration calls impacted Californians and families, along with healthcare and service providers and state and local leaders. Of course, you know, local government officials will be the ones to help put this into place if it does get passed. So they are certainly interested in being involved in understanding what this looks like. This will be the third such event that the governor has held on Care Court in recent weeks.
Yeah. Chris, given that California is home to the largest unhoused population in the country, I believe it's somewhere around 160,000 people in California, and there's currently an updated count that we should be expecting later this year. I remember Mayor Steinberg being on national media for his right to housing proposal. Care Court is something that the governor is proposing. Are there models elsewhere? How are they coming up with these proposals?
You know, I am not sure if there are other models that they're following, other specific models. I know that What they have said is that they are trying to respond to sort of the urgency of the moment, that what, you know, everybody, at least many people, see out on sidewalks in their communities with these large and growing tent encampments of people who, at least on the surface, appear to not be able to take care of themselves. And of course, that's a very controversial topic, as we heard from some of these civil rights advocates about the need to self-determine care. But that's where this is coming from. If you listen to the elected leaders, they say it's essentially they trying to meet the urgency of right now and deal with this growing problem.
Given the fact when talking about care courts, I'm kind of hanging on the part where you said, you know, several big city mayors are in support of this, both Democrat and Republican. Is that striking to you, given that you cover homelessness across the state?
It was interesting. I think that, you know, the state Republican lawmakers are not necessarily strongly backing this. We did see some mayors, for example, in Fresno and Bakersfield, Republican mayors who are supporting it. State Republican lawmakers held a press conference with their plans for homelessness. They mentioned care court. They did sort of modestly praise the governor for his plan, but they also said it doesn't go far enough. They'd like to see even greater accountability for people who are either committing crimes, greater forms of treatment.
Right.
And so they feel that this problem is not being addressed enough.
Cap Radio reporter Chris Nichols. Chris, thank you.
Thanks, Vicki.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. A strike by 4,600 Sac City teachers and other staff will continue today, impacting the district's more than 40,000 students. The Sacramento City Teachers Association and SEIU 1021 will rally again outside district headquarters and campuses. The strike is over two separate contracts. One involves COVID-19 protocols. The second is a labor agreement contract with the teachers union, which expired before the pandemic. Earlier this week, we had both unions and the superintendent on Insight to share their perspectives. This is the second time the teachers union has gone on strike in 3 years. The last time was a one-day walkout in 2019, the same year Sac City Unified was at risk of state takeover due to budget shortfalls. As we enter day two, we're joined by Sosan Marar, who covers school accountability and culture for the Sacramento Bee. Sosan, thank you so much for making the time. It's been a busy week for you.
Thank you for having me. Yes, it has.
This is the second strike in a few years, but it's also one of multiple strike authorizations in the past 5 years. You've been out there speaking with people impacted. What strikes you about what's unfolding?
That's a good question. I think this time is a bit different, right? Students have been at home for a large part of their lives in the last 2 years. They're finally back at school. You know, some parents that I've spoke with at these rallies are very supportive of the teachers union, are very supportive of the staff and say that things need to change. And some parents are growing really frustrated, saying that, you know, they're finally back at work and they don't have a place to put their children and they want their kids in the classroom.
As we mentioned, there's two separate contract disputes going on. Can you unpack what the crux of the reasons are?
Sure. So this SCTA, the Sacramento City Teachers Association, is complaining about the labor shortage in the district. So just looking at independent study, there are 14 vacancies currently and, you know, hundreds of kids on the wait list waiting for a teacher. Oftentimes, you know, students are corralled into the gymnasium or the classroom or the cafeterias because there aren't enough teachers or not enough substitutes at the schools. And their teachers are also concerned about the pandemic. They're saying that they want stronger health and safety protocols at their schools. The district proposed a 2% raise. They've also proposed signing bonuses of about $2,000. And they're saying that they will ensure that teachers have incentives to come work at Sac City Unified. But as we see today, negotiations are still at a standstill and they haven't come to an agreement on either side's proposals.
Given that campuses will be closed for day two and we don't know when this is going to end, why can't the district remain open amid a strike?
So SEIU went on strike with the teachers. And so that means maintenance workers, bus drivers, nutrition workers. So essentially these schools just simply can't run without the additional staff that all these schools have. So these are 40,000 students that cannot go to school because the schools simply can't run without all of the help.
Earlier this week, when we were talking with both of those unions, I remember a member of SEIU 1021 specifically highlighting COVID-19 concerns, saying that multiple members have been infected. They said that one passed away. Are you able to quantify on the COVID-19 protocol dispute between these unions how bad the issues are?
Well, there are concerns. I mean, we've heard even early on in the pandemic when, you know, we were noting every single death in Sacramento County that, you know, SEIU has lost, I think, one or two or more people to COVID-19, you know, that they were very concerned about, saying that there needed to be stronger health and safety protocols on campus. And that's justified in any workplace, right? The concerns are growing as students are back on campus, you know, masks are being lifted across the state. And so they want to ensure that their employees are safe on campus. One of the things that the unions are calling for is, you know, physical distancing, which we're not seeing a lot of at various schools. So the concerns are still there. The pandemic is not over, and they want to ensure that those things are enforced in their school district.
I know you mentioned that the district is offering a 2% increase in pay, I believe, in a $2,000 signing bonus. Is the superintendent or the district saying anything else in response to this strike?
Well, both union and the district have told me and told the public that they're waiting for the other to come to the table to say that they're ready to talk again. They've both put out their proposals. Neither are agreeing with the other proposal. So we're kind of just waiting to see when they'll come back to the table. The last I heard, as of this morning, there is no scheduled meeting.
And this comes just before the pandemic. The district was struggling to avoid insolvency, essentially going into the red, which would mean state takeover. Where is the district financially now? And are these budget shortfalls contributing to what's happening today?
Well, Sac City Unified, just like other school districts, have received a lot of COVID dollars. The union says there's plenty of money to go around. They say that money needs to be, you know, spent on the students. But the district tells me that they can't spend this money on one-time funding. So they don't want to place, you know, these dollars on anything that, you know, that needs to be ongoing expenditure. So this is something really important as they budget for this year and for future years. So I think there's conflict in that as well. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with SACB School Accountability Reporter Sosun Marar as we enter day two of a Sac City Unified strike. As you and your colleagues have reported, this is the fourth strike approval in 5 years for Sac City teachers, the second to actually take place. How are parents viewing this? Let's start with those who are in support of the strike.
Parents I have talked to at the rallies and through social media have told me that they side with their teachers. They see how exhausted they are. They're concerned about their children. Their children are coming home, you know, young children and teens are coming home telling them that they don't have teachers in their classrooms. Some students are spending several periods in the cafeterias, like I said, you know, without very much instruction because there's a lack of substitutes. At the same time, you know, like I said, parents are frustrated that their kids have been out of school for so long without consistent instruction that they're saying, you know, not this. This is not the time to strike, you know, meet at the table and keep these kids the priority.
When you're talking to parents, has there been one or two that kind of resonates with you more than others?
You know, I think the ones that really stuck out to me are the ones that have told me that they finally have gone back to work. As we know, there are a lot of offices have announced return to office. And it's those parents that, you know, really relied on the schools to be open. You know, these things kind of have to happen consistently, right? And consecutively, that these schools are opening at the same time as offices and the offices are opening at the same time as schools. And when parents are finally returning back to the workplace, their schools are closed. Mm-hmm. So this is a big concern for a lot of people that are scrambling to find childcare. Sacramento State President Nielsen had announced that, you know, we'll do everything we can to make things flexible. We have a lot of Sac State workers who have children in the school district. I talked to one parent who plans to bring her child to the university with her. So it's a really challenging time for a lot of parents.
Given that there are a total of 5 unions within the district, this strike involves 2 of them. Do you know what the other collective bargaining groups have to say?
Well, at the rally, several collective bargaining units have stood in solidarity. There's been a lot of support for this strike. And I think, you know, as you talk to folks in Sacramento, there's a lot of, it's a pro-union city, right? We are, generally very supportive of unions, and they stood in solidarity as SCTA and SCIU complained about staffing shortages. And this is a concern for them that other folks stood in solidarity with.
Earlier this week, when we're hearing from the unions, the superintendent joined us after, and he underscored and reminded us that over 70% of students are English language learners or students who qualify for free or reduced lunch or foster youth. The resources at one school can vary greatly from the next in Sac City Unified. School is also childcare, as you were talking about. It's nutrition, it's mental health, it's interaction. Is there an equity issue at play here?
Absolutely. So, you know, I spoke with one parent yesterday who told me that she wasn't able to secure a meeting or an appointment for her son in special education. This is something that a lot of students and families are struggling with, you know, ensuring that their kids can get the resources and services that they need at the district. A strike will only, you know, add more conflict to that. But they're telling me that these issues have been longstanding, right? That there have been, reduced resources at these schools. And in terms of equity, if we just look at, you know, where the substitutes are heading, you find that substitutes are, you know, inclined to volunteer and work at the more affluent neighborhoods, and the schools that have low income communities are really struggling to find substitutes. And the inequity there is really apparent.
Given that you not only cover school accountability, but you're also from Sacramento, Sac City Unified is one of more than a dozen school districts in Sacramento County alone. However, it's the only district going through budget shortfalls and labor disputes in recent years. Can you help us understand why?
That's a good question. I mean, these labor shortages are happening in every corner of the country. It's not just California and it's not just Sacramento. I think that what some education officials have highlighted, to me at least, is that other school districts just have stronger relationships between, you know, the labor partners and the school district, just healthy relationships. And I think that there has been a historical tension between these two in Sac City that some folks tell me the only way it will be resolved is that leadership on both sides step down and move forward. And this is something that I've heard time and time again, every time tensions build up between the two.
Yeah. And there is the risk of state takeover if the budget shortfalls continue. Can you explain what that would exactly mean? Because that is a worst case scenario.
Right. So the concern for that was even before the pandemic. If the district declares insolvency and says that, you know, they've essentially run out of money, they would appoint a, you know, state appointed, administrator who would kind of take over the school district and just essentially slash programs, resources for the schools, 80 schools in the district. And we've seen that in other school districts across the state. Oakland being one of them, they lost extracurricular activities. A lot of layoffs were happening. You know, some schools had closed. So these are serious concerns for a school district like Sac City Unified.
Yeah, and it can take more than a decade to financially recover. It's kind of comparable to like an extremely high interest loan. The AP says that Sac City Unified is actually the second big school district in the country this month to see a work stoppage following Minneapolis. But what's happening across school districts in California?
There have been other strikes. I mean, just Ronert Park, which is not too far from us, went on strike. It was a 6-day strike that was over wages, and they came to an agreement. You know, they started discussing at day 5, came to an agreement by day 6. But that kind of indicates a bit of concern for some families that I spoke with yesterday. Could this strike in Sac City go on for a week?
If it does go on for a week or even longer, what should parents know to prepare in terms of what resources are available, if any?
So we're working at the Sacramento Bee to include resources in our stories to make sure that people know, you know, what's open, if there's activities that they can send their children to. A question that we haven't seen answered yet is, you know, does the district have a plan to take that, you know, those days, depending on how many there are, and tack that on to the end of the school year? We're seeing those conversations happen across the country where students will just go to school for an additional week at the end of the school year in May or June. So time will tell to see if that happens at Sac City.
Yeah. Before we let you go, where's your reporting going to take you today and in the weeks ahead?
So it looks like they're rallying today outside of SCOE, the Sacramento County Office of Education. I've spoken with Dave Gordon, the Sacramento County Superintendent, and he asks that both come to the table to, you know, do right for the children. So we'll see if the strike goes on till tomorrow or if they decide to meet today.
Sosin, thank you so much for joining us and taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Sosin Marar is a school accountability reporter with the Sacramento Bee. As we enter day two of a Sac City Unified School District strike involving more than 4,600 teachers and staff, impacting more than 40,000 students. Still ahead, a local Latinx author and a familiar face on TV joins us with her latest bilingual children's book and the push for more diversity in publishing. You can join the conversation too. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Think of all the children's books being published. According to the University of Wisconsin, only 7% of American children's books feature Latinx characters or even subjects, and there's only 10% of Latinx authors and illustrators that actually get published in the United States. But our next guest is determined to break down those barriers and change the equation. Her latest children's book is called The Carousel King and the Space Mission, and it's about a brave little boy who overcomes his fears to take on and conquer new challenges. Leticia Ordaz is an award-winning Latinx children's book author and my former colleague and friend at KCRA, where she is the weekend anchor and reporter. In addition to all of that, including very early mornings and two young boys, Leticia also owns her own publishing company called Salido Lindo Books. Leticia, good morning and welcome back to Insight.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you, Vicky. So great to hear your voice. You're doing an amazing job. I love your show. I was your last in-person guest with Beth Vujak in 2020.
I know. I was told that. I'm so happy to have you back 2 years later. And obviously, I know you well. You're a busy mom of two boys, a wife, a journalist, but you just released your fourth children's book. What did you see lacking in the publishing world that inspired you to start writing bilingual children's books?
Definitely. I didn't know I wanted to become a children's book writer until I became a mother. And then it really hit me going to try to find those diverse books for my own children because I wanted to see representation. But just being really disappointed going to the bookstore and libraries and not seeing brown children on the pages represented in appropriate ways as the protagonists in stories. So that's when I knew I had to make a change and that I would have to find the time to write books. And that's what I've done in 2020. I published my first book, The Adventures of Mr. McCaw, just as the world shut down, but then new doors opened through the Zoom world. I've been able to bring this book to children everywhere in hospitals, throughout Mexico, throughout schools in the entire country. It's been a beautiful thing, Vicky.
Yeah, it really it has. And in addition to actually writing the books on the front end, you also decided to start your own publishing company. Why was this an important piece?
This was really important for me because when I wrote my first story, The Adventures of Mr. McCaw, I assumed right away that one of the top publishers in the country would need a book like this because there is such a need for bilingual books in our community throughout the country. But what the reaction I got was this book shouldn't be in Spanish because somebody said these words, Latinos don't read. And I was so angry to hear those words, just thinking, how could somebody say that about our community? And so I decided I needed to take action. I needed to start my own publishing house because that was a way for me to get my books out into the world and to prove them wrong And the beauty of this is that my books have been embraced by so many people. I've won so many awards against this publishing house that said that Latinos don't read. And I think what this mission is proving and those awards are proving is that people are reading these books. Latinos do read.
Yeah, and you've really just been like writing on fire. You're publishing your fourth book, The Carousel King. It's based on a letter your son wrote to the Sacramento Downtown Partnership during the pandemic. And it's all about believing in yourself. How did this book come about?
Yes, my son gave me the idea for the book. He's loved carousels and he overcame his fear of carousels when he was a little boy. And he also talks about space all of the time. So he said, Mom, what if we write a book where a little Latino boy and his brother go to space and build carousels? And I'm like, wow, that's a beautiful, wild idea. Children have like the best imagination. And it was all about believing in yourself. And he wrote a letter to the Sacramento Downtown Partnership. And he said, I want them to bring a carousel to Old Sacramento to liven up this space because the pandemic is happening. There's not a lot for children to do and families deserve joy. So he sat down and he wrote this letter. And me as a mother, I was kind of concerned. I said, what if they don't reply? What if he doesn't get his way? You know, I don't want his spirit to be crushed. So I said, okay, let's go for it. He wrote the letter. I sent it in. I mailed it in for him. And 3 months later, we got a phone call that they were installing a carousel in Old Sacramento because of a little boy's vision. They agreed with what he said. He got to be one of the first writers. And I wrote about that in the book because I want to show children that what they dream of, big or small, has the potential to come true. We should all believe in ourselves. Maxton believed in himself. Even when I, as a parent, wasn't sure what was going to happen with that request, he went for it. And we should always encourage our children to go for it. So we got to present this book to Scott Ford with the Sacramento Partnership. And he was so proud that, you know, this story was featured in the book. And I just hope that it allows all children to see their full potential and that anything is possible.
Yeah. Your son was believing in himself, but with others in mind. And now we have a carousel at the waterfront. You mentioned The Adventures of Mr. Macaw. That was your first book, but you also have That Girl on TV Could Be Me. And I would imagine it has a lot to do with you, right, Leticia?
Yeah, it is my children's autobiography. And it talks about being that little girl, you know, in Galt, California, where I grew up, watching the news and realizing from a young age that there wasn't a lot of representation in the media. I was that brown girl that even as a little girl was like, could that be me on TV? What if that was me on TV? And then other people would know that they too can have a voice in their community. So it talks about this little girl who was super shy in class, who was always asked to read and was terrified to read. And it talks about overcoming fears and becoming who you are meant to be. And I remember telling some teachers that I wanted to be a journalist. They were like, is that the right career for you? You're super shy. You're super inquisitive, but you're shy. Is that the right career for you? So I went for it, despite people telling me that maybe it wasn't the right career choice for me. And the reason the book is so important is because I feel like it defies odds and expectations for our youth. And if our youth want to do something, they should go for it, even if someone who is of authority tells them they can't do something. So si se puede.
Yeah, si se puede. You know, your idea now has a full-on momentum going now that you're on your fourth book, but you've also traveled across the country. You've traveled outside of the country. What has surprised you most about the reaction you're receiving?
It is so amazing how books are being embraced by everyone. We recently traveled last June to Cabo San Lucas and got to enter the orphanage, Casa Hogar. It's a very special place and they don't have a lot of books there. So I was determined to take my bilingual books to them. I reached out to the executive director and asked him if this was possible because we are in the middle of the pandemic. And he wasn't sure how the kids would embrace the books, but invited me to come on out and read to them. Well, I was only supposed to read for about 20 minutes, and I ended up reading to the kids for an hour. They did not want to let me go. And we passed out the books to them and started a literacy program with them. My books come with kites, so I told the children that for each book that they stood up and read to the group, they would be getting a kite. And we started this program, and when we left Cabo San Lucas, we got all these phone calls saying, you need to send in more kites. These kids are really taking on your challenge. They're getting up in front of the group and reading. They're becoming confident, like you told them to do, to read out loud, to read loud and proud. And so we've started this whole program. And this young boy, he was a poet and nobody knew it. A 16-year-old that had been in the orphanage for quite some time, and nobody knew that he'd been keeping a journal under his bed. But when he met me, he confided that in me, and I've been mentoring him. Aww. And he too is going to one day write his own stories, and nobody knew that about him. But my conversation with him and me visiting there gave him the courage to come out and tell the world that he's a writer too.
I would imagine how that makes you feel. Obviously, it's so profound and meaningful, but that must have been surprising to you too. You probably didn't know where this would take you when you started.
I had no idea, but I knew that I wanted to change the publishing world. I knew that I wanted my own children to see themselves on the pages. But now it's so beautiful for so many children to discover who they really are. I read to children in schools all of the time now. A couple of weeks ago, we did National Reading Week, and there were 200 schools that zoomed into one session in Nevada. And it was so powerful to hear the kids say the words in my book: you are brave, you are smart, you belong, you can do anything. And to hear them repeat after me, and to the look in their eyes, to know that they believed it too, because somebody told them they could do it. They're going to change the world, Vicki.
That must have been emotional.
Yes, it's hard not to cry with some of these. When you hear from the kids that they ask you questions and they say, those kids look like me. I'm no longer embarrassed to speak my home language. You know, a lot of them, their parents are Spanish speaking, and there is fear for them to continue to speak their language because they don't want to be ridiculed. But they are seeing in my books that are in English and Spanish that there is beauty in speaking both. There is power in speaking both. You can get a better job. And I just hope that they have the cultural pride, and that children who are not of Latinx descent, they too are embracing these books. They too are learning another language. They too are learning to love and respect thy neighbor. It's just a beautiful thing all the way around. And I'm so thrilled.
I have to ask, with the kites, obviously they're a lot of fun. They're great for children. How did that come about? Is there a symbolism to it?
So you know what? I never had a kite growing up. My husband never had a kite growing up, and he helped me come up with the idea when Mr. Macaw came out, because it is about a magical kite. It is about a magical kite that escapes us during Hurricane Bud in Cabo. That really happened to my children. My children love kites. And we said, what if we can mass produce them to go on with the story, a strong partner to the story, a companion to the story, where kids will not only want to read the book time and time again, but they're going to want to go have an adventure with their own families. So that's what we've done. We've made kites with all of our books, and children are really embracing it and wanting to read more because of it. So tying it all in, family bonding with reading, adventure with the kite, for us, it all goes together. And we send them to schools as an incentive when we read to the kids, and you know, they fly them around the campus during recess. They get exercise. We just think it's a win-win all the way around.
Yeah, it is a win-win. And there's a larger community behind this and beneath this, because you also partner with local nonprofits to distribute your bilingual books to underserved communities. How does that work?
Yeah, it's such a beautiful thing. We are doing one this weekend in West Sacramento at San Pedro Park, and kids who show up are going to get a free book and a kite. We're also doing another event for Cesar Chavez Day in Oak Park, and they're going to be giving 500 kids a free book and kite. So it's a matter of getting books into the hands of children. As we all know, in the publishing world, you don't make millions of dollars writing books. That's not why people should do it. I just want books into the hands of kids. So partnering with the Rotary Club and a number of organizations like the Resource Community Center in South Sacramento, it gives us the opportunity to touch families who have never owned a book. We've come across so many families who say this is the very first book they've ever owned. So it's starting their library. It's starting the love of reading for so many families. And so many families who speak Spanish who say, I've never been able to read a book to my kid until now. So it's just been super impactful. And that's my mission, to continue to not only write these books, but then make them accessible to our community, because there's no point in them just being in a bookstore that nobody can afford to buy. So I want them into the hands of kids where they can embrace a beautiful hardcover book and have that to pass on for generations to come, and then to light a spark in them for them to one day write their own story.
Yeah. We started with your children, your two sons, and we only have about 20 seconds left. But I just imagine they must have been shaped by this too, especially in the last 2 years, and seeing that all that you've accomplished.
It's been pretty amazing what they're doing. They're writing their own stories now, and they're giving me ideas. And it's just, you know, they know that representation matters at a young age, and they're going to see that that happens. And they also are encouraging their own friends to write their stories. So this has just blown up. And I hope that we can change those statistics that right now only 10% of Latinx authors get published in the country. That number needs to grow, and working together, anything is possible.
Leticia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. What an honor to be here.
Leticia Ordaz is an award-winning Latinx children's book author and my former colleague at KCRA, publishing her fourth bilingual children's book. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We will catch you back here on Monday.